So everybody, what I'd like us to do is to just go around and have you say your name, and then we will have discussion. Please ask a question in as concise a manner as possible, and then I can answer it, and then if somebody else has a commentary on it or a response to it, please feel free to add your point of view. So introduce yourself, and if you'd like to mention if you belong to a synagogue or where you live, it's fine to do whatever you'd like to do.
Bennett Solnick, PCS.
I'm Marion Silverman. We live in Solnick, New York, and we live at the York Capital Center.
And the worst have Paul's.
Diane Trilling.
Hi, Lisa Hamroth, Temple Bethel, Chappaqua, and I live in Chappaqua.
I'm Phyllis Tauber, Mama.
I love that.
Barbara Doctor, I belong to Temple Sherry Tefillah. I'm the bookkeeper for PCS.
And Lee Stern from Sherry Tefillah.
I'm Harry Stern, and I go with Lee from Sherry Tefillah. And we three at least do Torah study every Saturday morning. So we're, and these two are heads of adult ed, so we're pretty involved.
Great. I'm Joe Sachs from Summers.
And I'm Jane Sandbank. I'm a member here. I'm in Chippewa.
Jan Gordon, PCS.
Audrey Lenoff, PCS.
Peter Schaefer, PCS.
Peter Walters, PCS.
Karen Sanders, PCS.
As we go behind Jane.
Oh, all right. Rhea Wolfe, PCS.
Ofri Felder, Katana, PCS.
I'm Sharon Friedman. I live in Pleasantville, and I'm a member here.
Ari Abiram, Rohan Hudson.
David Benatar, PCS.
Itzik Min, CSI.
Seth Rutman, right here at PCS.
Rabbi Mark Sanath, I'm here at PCS.
Do we have somebody behind Itzik?
No.
Nina. Nina Abiram.
Rohan Kremlis. Rohan. All right, so would anybody like to open the floor with questions? Peter?
An easy one, Sarah. You have on the map Vilna as part of Poland.
Yes.
Now, Vilna was Lithuania.
Ah, so in World War, at the end of World War I, the Poles fought hard to have Vilna, which in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth of the 1516 and early 1700s, Vilna was an integral part of Poland. And so they fought a war, in fact, with the Lithuanians, and they won the province of Vilna, and that's why Vilna was part of Poland. In fact, Józef Pilsudski, who was the hero of the Polish national movement, was in fact from Lithuania, and he was either a Polonized Lithuanian or a Pole from a Polish nobility that had settled in Lithuania back in the day. So Vilna was part of Poland.
Messianism, a response to deeply problematic present. I just want to clarify that you mean that specifically in terms of Jewish messianism and not messianism in general, of which there are many forms, and there's a whole Christian world out there of billions of people who are very involved in messianism.
That's a great question. I myself have studied the messianic impulses within Jewish tradition and the Jewish people. My guess is, however, that, but I don't want to be quoted on this, that any messianic movements are in all likelihood responses to a problematic present because they seek some idealized redemptive future. But certainly in the Jewish case we see here, these messianic impulses are a response to a present that is absolutely unfulfilling and worse.
Mm-hmm. And yet it's become so normative in the broad Christian world.
Well, that's an important thing to take into consideration. Perhaps there's something to pay attention there. What is it that is seen as terribly problematic about the present that mm-hmm. is bringing messianic impulses, and that's not only in the Christian world, we have it in other worlds too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we had Seth back there. We'll make sure we get to everybody. And if I don't say your name, just remind me.
Okay. I just have also an easy question. You mentioned that Jews have been in that in Poland since about the 800s. Do you have a sense of where they came from?
Well, the vast majority came from the German lands. That's overwhelming the historians know. Now, the 800s, you have very few. The momentum takes, in the 1200s, things really pick up in response to the Crusades and to the persecutions and expulsions from the German lands. So Polish Jewry is predominantly, that's why we call it Ashkenaz in the rabbis, was the German lands. So
were there also Sephardic Jews that moved there thinking it was even much better there than where they were coming from?
There probably were some Sephardic Jews who made their way over by way of the Ukraine and Crimea, etc., but not the majority. But there were. But historians seem to feel the vast majority were coming from the West.
Can you talk about the relationship of the church and the nationalist movement in Poland?
Yeah. So this was a problem. The church, unfortunately, tragically, abetted the anti-Semitism during this interwar period. They worked alongside of, in many ways, the nationalist government and nationalist politicians to develop this concept of Poland for the Poles, which meant Catholic Poles. That Poland was a Catholic country, and it's a sad state of affairs that the Catholic Church seemed to feel that was the direction it was going in. Very interestingly, if we had to compare another minority group in Poland at this time to the Jews, this is probably going to really shock you. The group that was probably closest were the Germans who were in Poland. The ethnic Germans who lived on the Western and Silesia and Pomerania and all of those places. And why is that? They were highly urbanized. They were Protestant primarily, so they were represented a religious minority. They had their own language, German. And they were fairly spread out in some ways, although more along the Western Corridor. And in fact, the German Poles, if you want to call it like that, and the Jewish Poles, in the early part of this era, they actually worked together to try to forge some alliances, some of the Jewish groups, let's say. But as the Nazis gained power and the nationalist far-right extreme rhetoric gains in strength, those Germans begin to side with their German brothers across the border, and they turn away from the Jews.
Yeah. Going back to Messianism, we see it in our days. The Lubavitch Rabbi is considered a Mashiach by some people. And the whole Gush Emuni movement in Israel had a messianic fervor to it. And, you know, the coming of the
Well, yes, this messianic impulse has been taken over in many ways by the settler movement, who believes that they are redeeming all the land of Israel for the sake of God in order to have a complete Torah society that follows the rule. It's a theocratic vision, but they also bring in the land piece, which had not been so dominant. They've combined territorial expansion of the revisionist with this messianic impulse
of reconquering the land, the center of what was ancient Israel.
That's
after
correct.
The Six-Day War, there was this whole fervor.
Absolutely, that is absolutely correct, and that's a strong. It has a lot of energy. By the way, messianic impulses have a lot of force behind them, and that's why you see some of the settler movements in Israel have a lot of energy behind them because of this redemptive impulse. Yep.
Yeah.
Ofri. So Ofri was there, and then I'll go to you,
sure.
Ofri. Uh huh.
I just wanted to say, and maybe I have a biased Israeli perspective, but I see the settler movement and Gush Emunim as more of an American phenomena that has been important to Israel as and not at all a Zionist Israeli phenomena. And maybe by this time around, it's, you can't make that division as clearly, but certainly I think if you look at the origins of the Gushamunim movement and the settler movement, a lot of those Jews came from the United States. And if you're talking about Messianism, you have to ask, what is it that drove Rabbi Kahana from the United States as a Jew here to find that solution in Israel?
Well, that let's keep that. If some of you have responses, that's important. Now, but the only thing is that I Ofri, that I do want to say is that Rav Kook, who was becomes the chief rabbi of Israel, and he was let's say, I don't really think he was so much part of the if you look on the Mizrahi Rav Kook, I believe he was Polish, of Russian origin, perhaps. I have to double check that. But his basic premise was that, the Zionists are, even if they're secular, they are doing the work to lay the foundation for the coming of the Messiah. And that's why Rav Kook was prepared to work with the secular Zionists, while Agudas Yisrael hated them and didn't. They ended up working with them, and now they do work with them in Israel, but were very hostile to secular Zionism. Rav Kook said, you have it wrong. They don't know that they're bringing the Messianic era religious concept, but they are. And we have to work with them because we want to make sure we have a Torah true Jewish state, a real Jewish state. Now, his son was the one who takes that to a new level and reinterprets Rav Kook's ideology. Yes, what's your name again?
I would like you to explain more about what you think the similarities are between Poland of this period and our current period. I mean, I see them as very poor, striving to get a little bit, whereas I see us as very wealthy, not striving, not looking for the crusts of bread. I see diversity without hostility all over the place, a tremendous amount of it. I just want to ask, where do you see the similarity?
Okay, so first of all, let me, before I give you my point of view, let's ask you. Maybe you say, hey, I heard what you just said, Sarah, and I disagree with you. I don't think there are any parallels, whether we weren't talking about America. And by the way, there's a whole piece of Jewish politics and the American Jewish political scene at this time, but it wasn't fractious, at least within the America, mm-hmm. too much. Not like in Poland, and we can only do so much, but we could have also looked at the case study of America in this time period, but it was not as interesting as the Polish and not as fractious. So maybe do any of you here see that there are similarities, or do you not think that there are too many similarities?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's hear. And look, what is your name again?
Harry.
This is what historians do. They take the facts and then they interpret the facts. So I don't want to give my reasons, but let's hear what other people see, as you've brought up some very significant points. Yes, we are very wealthy. We have power, real power. Jews have power in the state of Israel. These people have no power.
We have power here in the United States.
Yeah, we have power here in the United States. We have clout. So maybe my thesis is incorrect. But let's hear what other people have to say. Yes,
Talking about the United States, I'll just give you an example. I went to a camp as a child, Camp Masad, where people from the Reform Movement, from the Orthodox, from the Reconstructionist, secular Jews, were all together in a Hebrew-speaking camp. You would never find that now. There is such antagonism between within the Orthodox, the Orthodox conservative, the Orthodox and the Reform, the right-wing conservative, the left-wing conservative. It's such a balkanization of the Jewish community in this country now that it's very disturbing. And I keep thinking about this time when I was in a camp with kids who went to secular schools and Hebrew schools and day schools and yeshivot, and it was all one. So
there's one argument why we see even in within the ranks of people who care, there's a tremendous amount of disunity. So that's and I'm not necessarily trying to take to or win my side. I think you've made some good points, actually, that we need to keep in mind as well. So, Peter, you wanted to say something?
I was going to say I grew up in a socialist. I think we have the same background. And there was a split in the 1950s between the left and right in Judaism. Mm-hmm. We were Orthodox. We left Orthodoxy because we couldn't take the politics or anything else. So, yeah. It started back then.
Yeah. So the seeds were already there.
They were planted.
Barbara?
I was going to ask an additional question on this topic. Is this model that we've just learned about in Poland at this time unique to Poland, or was the greater Jewish world split this way, and did we inherit this from Poland or from history in general?
Okay, so this is an excellent question, but we need to get back to the question of why is Poland interwar similar to today. All right, so Poland is almost like, it's like a excellent test case or case study of what was happening in the other East Central Europe. Soviet Union is a totally different story because everything is suppressed, but in Romania, in Czechoslovakia, which was actually, Czechoslovakia was the best place for the Jews in East Central Europe because their government really was tolerant and democratic and liberal. We've got, let me check the, so I just want to make sure, okay, yes. Lithuania, the independent Lithuania, Latvia, Eastern Czechoslovakia, and Romania were very similar to Poland. But the reason why the Polish case is so important is because so many Jews from Poland went to the land of Israel and were so influential in establishing the state. And that's a piece of it, that their experiences in Poland really shaped, in many ways, what becomes the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Sephardic world? I'm trying to get at whether there's something about being Jewish that inspires this kind of fractiousness, or is it more cultural to parts of Europe?
Definitely in Europe, in East Central Europe, in this era, you have this going on with other groups, with Ukrainians, with Belarusians. You have this kind of factionalism, but in the Jewish case, it's really pronounced. As for, is there anything, some kind of essential Jewish argumentative gene?
Yes.
The answer is yes. No, I don't know. I'm very wary of essentialist arguments of any kind. Do we see a certain cultural tolerance for disputation? I would say absolutely. There's something in the Talmud that's called a machloket. A machloket is when one rabbi and another rabbi, or two different schools like Hillel and Shammai, you've heard of, they disagree, and sometimes there's no answer given. Nobody wins. So this notion of machloket is part of the intellectual and cultural baggage of Jewish life. But I don't want to say that this is why you see this happening in interwar Poland. It may be, but there are other things, as I think you saw, that were also propelling this, and it wasn't only Jews who were having these internal
divisions. Right, but with Harry's argument, we don't have a lot of those things today, those same needs, but yet we do have this.
Absolutely.
We still have that.
We still have this.
Okay, so that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Well, there's also the idea that of Jewish unity, and it's honored more in the breach than in the reality. So that's another piece that maybe we're fighting this notion of, well, the Jews should be one, but maybe that's an incorrect perception that we need to adjust. So let's say, yes,
well,
Dad?
I don't know if this is on the subject exactly, but I wanted to ask you, what is it about the currently in the United States, about the right-wing Republican and the evangelicals that are so pro-right-wing Israeli policies? What's the connection that makes them, think they're brothers?
Does somebody want to respond to that?
Yeah, because I just recently back from Israel, and I was struck by that because they were mourning the fact that we weren't supporting Michelle Bachmann.
What?
They were mourning the Zionist right-wing Israelis couldn't understand and kept asking us why we weren't supporting Michelle Bachmann. And I think it goes back to this messianic vision. The evangelicals and the Zionists are allied in this idea of the Messiah and it being in Israel, so that the Israeli state has to be maintained.
But that would
I mean, that's...
I understand what you're saying, but that's but you're turning this a little bit. You're giving an example of a certain number of Israelis that are, of that persuasion that are missing Michelle Bachmann. I want to know what is the reason that the evangelicals and the right-wing Republicans are so, attached to the Israeli right, and as a corollary of that, by the way, from my reading of the Jewish press from Israel, it's completely different views about President Obama in Israel than the news that's reported here. And with all these right-wing so-called Jews here favoring the Republicans, it's claiming that they're on the side of the Israelis when the Israelis are not on that side at all.
Okay,
it's
so
total
let me...
misrepresentation in the media press here about the Jews here.
Okay, so let me step in. I'm going to take the liberty of cutting off my father,
right.
Which is not that uncommon. talk about argumentation. So you're quite one of the things that I think allies the right here with the right there is. I think your messianic notion is an important one, but I also think that it's a response to a rapidly changing social structure in the United States and a very unstable social structure in Israel. The question of what defines a society. And the Republicans here and the evangelicals have a vision of America as a white dominated, individualist, nation, and a white bread nation, if you want to call it that. And that's not the country anymore, and they are resisting it. And in Israel, the notion of having a pluralistic society, and I'm going to get to your point why I think the parallels are really strong. What are they going to do about having millions of Palestinians under their control and calling themselves a Jewish democratic state? This has been change that's happening for a while, but it's scary. Because if the whole principle is that we are Jewish and a democracy, the reality is you're not a democracy right now, if according to the definitions of what a democracy is. And if you continue to hold on to the West Bank, you're not going to be majority Jewish either. So that puts into question the entire Zionist project. And so that is very scary for the right wing, because they don't actually have answers except answers like, expel the Arabs, or let's have an apartheid state. Those are not my statements. Those are Ehud Olmert and Barak. They've said that same thing. I want to make sure everybody is. Did you want to respond?
I have two things. First, talking about why, and I'm not Republicans, but why evangelical Christians are such supporters of Israel. They believe the Bible literally. And in the Bible, it says, if you bless Israel, you will be blessed. If you curse Israel, you will be cursed. I think that might go into the equation. I mean, they really believe that. So that might be one reason why they're supportive. Second, well, did you say it's not a democracy? Israel's not a democracy.
Well, right now, okay, you're going to shoot me if you want. What I'm saying, on the other side of the green line, it's not a democracy. Let me clarify. Within Israel, you have a quite vibrant democracy. In fact,
right.
It's not a perfect democracy.
What is?
But you have a Arab Israeli on the Supreme Court. You have Arabs in Parliament, even if there's contested. You have schooling. You have even Arab Druze and Bedouin who are in the military. So we have, you have a fairly open press. I mean, you wouldn't be able to have a politician, Ehud Olmert, some of you read the Times yesterday. He came to America and he was booed by the American Jews for saying that Obama is a good president and we shouldn't, that Netanyahu shouldn't escalate the Iranian issue. He was booed, but because he comes out of a democratic culture that's very fractious, by the way, he can say that. And he doesn't have to worry about going back to Israel and getting put in prison. So we definitely have, the concern is that the beyond the green line, it's not tragically a democracy. And how do we deal with that?
Yeah, that's
and it's yes.
Clarify.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah.
I think this young lady mentioned it or asked, is there this fractionalism in the Sephardic community?
Wait, that's a whole other story, and I'm thinking, Ofri, I was going to talk to you about next year. I should do it the history of the Jews of Arab lands in modern times, because we have completely neglected the Jews of the Mizrahi Sephardic Jews, and that's a big mistake because they make up over 50% of the Jewish population of Israel. So, but no, there wasn't this kind of fractious divisiveness, partially because the larger cultural context didn't bring it out in the Sephardic Jews. So that's a really good question. And the center of Jewish life was clearly Europe, and then America in gaining momentum, and then the Land of Israel. So, but the whole issue of, well, the Shas party is an outgrowth. Okay, I'll give you an example of why this is relevant. Agudas Yisrael is a party born in Poland of Ashkenazi Hasidic Jews. The Shas party, which stands for Shomrei Sfarad, or the Guardians of Sephardim, was a party that was founded in 1984 by a Litvak, a Lithuanian rabbi named Eliezer Shach, who defects from Agudas Yisrael and supports the Sephardim, who feel really like they don't have representation. The Orthodox Sephardim, the ultra-Orthodox Sephardim, don't feel that they're getting representation by Agudas Yisrael. They have all their meetings in Yiddish. They don't even understand anything. And so Eliezer Shach decides to help them to form their own party. He also then splits and forms another party called Degel HaTorah, and then he goes back and unites with the Agudas and forms United Torah Judaism, which is now a swing party in the Knesset, and Shas is now a very big power player. So they kind of did a Sephardic Agudas Yisrael, a spin. So that's one of the reasons why this time is quite important and similar, because the question of the politics, religion and politics mixing is a fact of life in Israel, and it's the sources of that fact of life are in interwar Poland. Mm-hmm. So that there's a carryover there. And the notion that we don't want a Zionist state, but we're going to participate in politics because one day we want a theocracy that's run by the Torah sages, the Council of Torah Sages. That idea began with Agudas Yisrael. It migrated, and then they have a spinoff with Shas. So it's very, there's a strong line of continuity. In fact, the reason why you have the whole sphere of civil marriage, divorce, burial, is all in the hands of the ultra-Orthodox, is because when the partition plan came up in 1947, the general Zionists who had influence, and Ben-Gurion, the socialist Zionist, in order to present a united front for once to the world, they went to Agudas Yisrael and said, we need your help here. So Agudas Yisrael said, if you give us power in the domains of marriage, divorce, burial, we will sign on with you that we are ready to accept the partition plan. That lay the foundation for their participation in the political process in Israel. But had there not been a Agudas Yisrael founded in Poland, we wouldn't have that today.
Wow.
So that's the origin, Bennett?
So that's another parallel between what happened in Poland and what's going on in Israel, is that the parliamentary system preserves all these factions that all get this tiny bit of participation and a certain amount of power, and, you know, for good or bad, that's part of the system.
I think that's a very strong argument. That's right. You continue to see this fractiousness in the Israeli political spectrum, this notion of having a million parties who are hating each other, but who then make deals behind the tables with each other. They transfer loyalties. I mean, why would Labor make an alliance with Agudas Yisrael? They have nothing in common because they're jockeying for the Jewish street, and they're jockeying now. They have real power. So that is another important component. It's a behavior pattern that endures. Ofri?
I actually agree with this gentleman. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name.
Bennett.
With Ben?
Bennett, yeah.
Bennett, mm-hmm. That the parallels, you know, the time period that you described in Poland is really important for understanding Israeli politics. But that Jewish pluralism in the United States kind of sidestep possibly this, the influence of this era, because the main point of immigration came a little earlier. And it raises the question of when is it pluralism and when is it fragmentation? Mm-hmm. I think the biggest accomplishment of American Jewry is religious pluralism, which doesn't exist in Israel. But there are two other questions, and I don't have them quite formed, but one has to do with Jewish identity. We're talking about really different notions of what it means to be Jewish, and I think that sometimes we tend to exclude those interpretations of Judaism that don't really sit well with us. So I find that right now in the American-Israeli schism, the geographical element is becoming the most pronounced. And Americans are starting to say, well, we are the liberal Jews, as opposed to, the schism being one between more progressive Jews in Israel and the United States, and a vision of Judaism that is more mired in the past in the United States and in Israel. It seems like the geographical division is becoming the most pronounced.
Okay, so this is, I think, yes, that's very, I think that's, I think from the point of view of are we in schism today, which is where this talk starts, and this is an important point, and I'll get back to you. I think that one of the markers that we are in schism is that the two largest Jewish communities in the world, namely the American and the Israeli, that geography has created a very different understanding of Jewish identity and of the meaning of Jewish religion and the meaning of Jewish secularism, for example. So that we are in danger of no longer being able to speak the same language anymore with our Israeli brethren, so to speak, even potentially those who are more similar to us, perhaps in political outlook, that there's a really different way of understanding the Jewish present. That's an important point to take into consideration. Now, the truth is that in this time period as well, American Judaism was already developing very differently than European Polish Judaism, and that's another parallel that I kind of hid from you. Why? Because American Jews during this era are becoming increasingly integrated into American society and into the American political establishment as Americans. And they're not defining themselves as a Jewish national minority. They don't want that. In fact, on the contrary, they want to see themselves as Americans of the Jewish faith. Americans who are Jews by religion. And so, and this is going in a very different direction. In fact, that notion of acculturation is completely out the window in Poland at this time. That seems like the least viable one. And so we're seeing that, interestingly, also today within the American and the Israeli culture, that national identification is not determined, is determined in different ways. I mean, Jewish identification is determined differently in America than in Israel, with really significant circumstances to how you see, by the way, how you see the other, how you see your those who aren't Jewish. Yes, you have a question?
I noticed you had Peter Beinart's book on your desk, and is he part of our schism conversation? He caused quite a brouhaha when...
I read his book, and he is saying that we are in schism already. He's saying that American Jews, by and large, are divided between those who are living in a fantasy world that Israel is a liberal democracy, and those American Jews who feel that Israel is the opposite, and are and how that plays itself out, and he's actually saying that there's a schism in American Judaism. It's not a schism between Israel and America, although he also is worried about that. He feels that Israel is heading to become a conservative theocracy, and that American Jews who care about liberal democracy need to take a stand. I have some problems with his book, but I think, I don't think that his answers are necessarily good ones, but I think his book is worth reading as a kind of primer for what's happening right now. I would recommend people reading it, and I actually feel that his book is giving people a little bit of courage to address the fact of this schism. I think that he's allowing people to come out and say, hey folks, we're going in a direction that may not be good for the Jewish people worldwide, and take a step back. So,
but the response, I thought, was overwhelmingly negative.
Yeah, because the Jewish establishment is in America is very uncomfortable with what he's saying. That's okay. I can be uncomfortable with it. Sometimes you have to say uncomfortable
things.
You're
fighting things back, though.
Yeah. Peter, yes. Peter, we have Peter, and then we have Seth in the back. And also, I want you to get your sorry. I'll get you next.
One, I think, would perhaps reflect on what Barbara's question was, and the fractiousness. I don't think we should forget that this history that you so well described, and the other fractiousness among Jews. We are talking, today's fractiousness here in maybe this country, we are talking about a minority of the Jews. The majority of the people are not involved in the debate. So when we talk about the 50 different, you know, the majority of people don't think in these terms. First of all, they don't come to the synagogue, they don't come to these lectures, they don't even pretend that they have a very big opinion, and if they have a big opinion, they say, well, you know, there's no God, so why should I go? Or what somebody says, I can't influence what happens in Israel, I'm not in Israel, okay? So the great majority is not involved in any of these debates, and although I wasn't in Poland, I don't think they were in Poland either. They lived, they, you know, baked bread and made clothing and whatever, and they were trying to make a living. And some people were Zionists, and the joke went, at least in my town, you know, that a Zionist is a person who wants to get another Jew to another country on other people's money. that was a Zionist. So the majority is not involved. And the ones who are involved are obviously having different opinions. So it is sort of a natural thing that if you look at the elite that thinks, or the elite that acts, or the elite that, you know, that you will find a lot of different opinions. The fact that we have, you know, two-party system in this country, I don't think there's another country in the world that has a two-party system. It's either one or many. But two, you know, somehow doesn't. The other thing that I'd like to say something about is this question of nations. We seem to be poo-pooing the notion that nationhood involves territory and language.
No, I'm not.
And I always thought that without territorial unity of language, you don't have a nation, because you don't have the same culture, you don't have the same thoughts and the same goals and the same aim. And if you look at any European country, Poland was not a unique in the sense that Poland was for the Poles, or that was the idea. Hungary was for
Hungary. Hungary was even worse. They were much more extreme, actually.
And France, you couldn't be...
But France and England had a different model. They
France
had a model
had
where
France
you,
had a little different model because they had the Africans, you know, they had to do something with it. But if you were a European wanting to become a Frenchman, you really couldn't. And let alone the Swiss, okay? So you look
That's
around,
true, I've lived there.
So if you accept that the nation is or needs territory language, then one should not be surprised that with time the American Jews are not going to be the same as Israelis. I mean, my family members from Israel who live there say to me, when I said, you know, I'm going over to Torah study, why didn't you come with me? He said, I'm an Israeli. I don't have you have to be
right.
You have to be a Jew in America. That's how you are a Jew in America. But I don't have to be that way in Israel because I'm an Israeli.
So I think I'm gonna jump in here and I'm gonna say that this relates to the question of Jewish identity that you have in the modern era, built into the Jewish situation. A breaking down of a coherent idea of what characterizes being a Jew. Not who is a Jew, but what is a Jew. And that's why I gave you some questions to think about. And we still have not, we still are struggling and wrestling, those of us who care, like you say, to figure that out. I do want to say, though, that the notion that a nation has to have a land and a language, that was actually the piece about the territoriality was disputed, that as the heritage actually of thinking in the Austro-Hungarian Empire was that you could actually be an extraterritorial nation. And the fact that the Jews argued in Poland that the fact that we don't have a land of our own and that we don't have a language of our own, doesn't make us not a nation, that we're still a nation now. Because the prevailing sentiment among the European Gentiles was what you're arguing for, that notion of an extraterritorial nationhood collapsed and did not become a reality. But as we who are interested in notions of nationhood and nationalism, there's no such thing in the stratosphere called nation. Human beings construct the idea of what it means to be a nation. There's no given. And it's your interpretation that has won the day often, but it wasn't inevitable. In fact, the Jewish nation, the fact that you can convert and become a Jew is already a challenge to that modern notion of nationhood, because that notion is one from antiquity. If you convert religiously, your ancestor was Abraham. Which I think is actually a pretty cool thing, but it's certainly not something that's part of the modern national, certainly of this ethnic national. You know, there's an idea of you can have what the French call droit de sol or droit de sang, the right that you are a citizen of a nation by virtue of the fact that you were born there, or that you are a citizen by virtue of the fact that you have a bloodline. And in East Central Europe, the dominant motif moving from Germany eastward was that it's a bloodline. And this is one of the parallels, that Israel also has that nationhood and citizenship is determined by blood, not by land. And so Israel, the Jews took that understanding of what constitutes belonging to a nation with it when it settled. And this is, by the way, America is one of the few nations that has that you become a member of the nation by the fact that you were born there. Most European nations don't have that, by the way. The law of return is alive and well in Germany. If you're an ethnic German from Russia and you can trace back an ancestor 150 years ago, you can have citizenship in Germany right away. Same law of return that we have, that Israel has. Okay, this lady, please, yes, go ahead. Lee, right?
Yeah, thank you. I was just thinking about the comparisons between American Jews and Jews in Israel. And it's the deep foundation is for 250 years we've been living in a country where church and state are separate. Israel is a theocracy.
And it has theocratic elements.
It has very strong theocratic elements.
Tendencies, we'll
yes.
say.
And that 250 years is a long time in a lot of generations, and it has to have an impact. And I believe it has had an impact in our differing ideas of what constitutes a Jew. I mean, the Israeli guy, he doesn't have to go to tours. He's a geographical Jew. He lives in Israel. That's it, you know. Whereas we don't have the geography, so we have to have something else. And those are basic differences that no amount of talk is going to change. Can't change history.
Yeah, so, good. Okay, so it's 9:30. We'll take two more questions, and because I don't want to keep people too late tonight. But want to make sure, Peter, you had something you'd want to say?
Yeah, I just want to say a schism within America is generational. This is the biggest.
Ooh, and that's another area.
Jewish Week ran something recently. It was a front page article. It struck me that among young Jews, what is the single most important element of being Jewish?
Right.
And if you hadn't read the article, nobody in this room would guess.
I read the article.
Social justice. A sense of social justice. 40% of the young people said this is what makes us a Jew. And the next biggest answer was under 20%. So the split, this is young people. The importance of Israel to young Jews, I think about 4 or 5%, it was some number
minute.
So
there's another schism in the making, and that's an important one. Generational schism is very very influential. And of course you have, every generation has to fight the previous generation. I think the question here is there a tipping point in those schisms that really indicates some seismic shift that we have to pay attention to? That's the piece. Audrey?
Yeah, you know, when we get back to the concept of schism, I had mentioned to you, the whole concept of monotheism was a Jewish thing. Everything after that was a schism. Well, that's how these other religions came about.
Well, Christianity and Islam are, you could say in some ways, I don't know if I would go this way. Well, Christianity is definitely schismatic from Judaism. Islam is not really necessarily schismatic, but it draws upon Judaism and Christianity in its conceptualization. But certainly the Jewish Christianity is born out of schismatic that we looked at in the first session.
Well, see, I don't see this as a Jewish problem. I see this as a peoplehood problem. And as long as people exist and have minds and can think, we're going to have schisms. We're going to have people who disagree.
So the reason we have schism is because Jews are so smart, right? Just joking. Please don't record that. Okay. Thank you all so much for coming, and have a good evening, and keep the conversation going.